Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello and welcome to Quality of Life. My name is Joe Moore. There's no doubt that Californians love their cars, and the Central Valley is no exception. But with rising fuel prices, the struggling economy, and a desire to be more environmentally friendly, many Valley residents and leaders are looking at mass transit as an option, both for today and for the future. Last week, U.S. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood announced that President Obama's new 2012 budget includes a nearly $18 million grant to help fund a so-called bus rapid transit system for Fresno, serving the Blackstone and Ventura Avenue corridors. The system, which would likely cost nearly $50 million at build-out, would be the first of its kind in the Valley. This news comes less than 2 months after a major rate hike went into effect for the city's existing bus service. We'll learn more about what a bus rapid transit system would look like and what it means for users in just a moment. Later in the program, we'll talk with a guest from the Public Policy Institute of California on the release of a new study that calls for the state to raise the cost of driving to help incentivize the use of transit. But right now we're joined in our studio by John Downs. He is the Planning Division Manager for the Department of Transportation of the City of Fresno, Fresno Area Express.
Fresno Area Express.
John, yes. Welcome to our program today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tell us a little more about this term that we're starting to hear. It's being used in other parts of the state and nation and globally. It's called bus rapid transit. This is different than the normal bus lines and routes that we see, the FACTS buses around town on an everyday basis. How does it differ?
I should put it like this. The goal of bus rapid transit is to reduce dwell time. When anybody who's ridden a bus before in Fresno understands it, you get in the bus, it rolls down the road about a quarter of a mile to the next stop, and it pulls over. It lets all the traffic go by while it's boarding passengers, and then it pulls back out and gets into the back of the platoon of cars going forward, and it rolls another quarter of a mile and stops and does this. Every time the bus stops, we call that a dwell. So the goal of bus rapid transit is to reduce the dwell time. So there are lots of techniques and technologies we use to do this. One technique is called transit signal priority, where when the transit bus approaches a signalized intersection, the computer controls talk to each other on the bus and on the control system, and it either gives a few additional seconds of green light time for the bus, or in some cases it reduces the amount of red light time in the bus. So we do this throughout a corridor, and that increases the speed of the system. Another technique we use is we have fewer stops. So instead of stopping every quarter of a mile, we only have a bus stop every half of a mile. So that reduces dwell time. Another technique is what we call a queue jump lane, where basically if you think about pulling in an intersection that has the right-hand turn pocket, we will set the signals up so when the bus is approaching that intersection, it pulls over in that right-hand turn pocket. The right-hand turn signal empties the pocket of the cars here, lets those cars make their movement. When the bus pulls up to that intersection, the bus has a special transit signal that allows it to go out first ahead of the cars. So that increases our time. Other techniques include level boarding platforms, so you don't have to climb stairs to get on the bus. You just walk directly onto the bus. As you would in a light rail system, we collect the fares off the bus. So when you're getting on the bus, you don't have to line up at the fare box and drop your change in. You just keep on walking because you've already paid your fare. So all of these techniques combined with some new technology allow us to maybe cut the travel time off of that system by as much as 25% or 30%. So the big advantage is you get from point A to point B faster.
Now, I've heard it described as almost equivalent in some ways to light rail, except in the case of light rail, you have heavy steel rails that are in the roadbed, electrification equipment. In this case, you're still using a bus with rubber wheels.
A lot of people call it light rail on rubber wheels, and in its most advanced form, that's exactly what it is. That advanced form would include exclusive right-of-way. So, for instance, in a light rail system, typically you don't see any cars operating on the same corridor as the light rail does. It's operating its own corridor, which means it's not stuck in traffic. It's doing its own thing. We're not going to get quite that far at this point in Fresno. We do have some exclusive right-of-way, which is more properly described BAT lane or business access and transit. So some of the corridors can be established so that it cars are not supposed to travel in that lane, but they're allowed to enter the lane and lead the lane to the through on-ramps or whatever to get to the businesses associated along that corridor. But that's not happening. That's only a couple of miles in this particular corridor. I think as we look forward, Fresno will eventually evolve to a point where it will need exclusive travel lanes, but that's not part of this project.
Now, what's driving this effort? This obviously didn't just come about last week from the president. This showed up by surprise in the budget. And again, as we know in the budget process from our civics classes, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be in the final version approved by Congress. But this is something that's, as I understand it, been in the works for a number of years.
We've been working on this project for 3 years. We three years in earnest on BRT, Bus Rapid Transit. We actually started probably about 2003 when we're doing a long-range transit plan. Exploring light rail was the goal of that plan. From that, we went forward and we started looking at a bus rapid transit plan, which includes several corridors in Fresno. And through the planning process, we've narrowed it down to these two primary corridors that we're planning on putting the service on. So we've been doing a lot of planning, a lot of preliminary environmental screening in order to prepare the grant application that goes to the Federal Transit Administration. And this is sort of the culmination of that process.
But what is the driving force behind it, the rationale behind this service?
In Fresno, we have very high public transit ridership. I mean, we carried over 18 million passenger trips last year. So we have a lot of business on this bus, and we have a lot of crowded buses. Probably the number one drawback to using public transportation in Fresno is the length of time it takes you to get from place to place. I mean, anybody who drives knows that there's probably not many places in Fresno you couldn't get to in 20 or 25 minutes. On a bus, very frequently, you might have to take an hour, perhaps an hour and a half to get someplace. So we're really trying to reduce that travel time. We're trying to make the bus more convenient. We'd like to be able to attract more choice riders, people, you know, who are currently driving cars or generally only drive cars. And of course, the goals behind that are about air quality and about pollution and about our built environment and, you know, a number of issues. But those are the things behind it.
That number, 18 million, that seems remarkably high. At least it's higher than I would have perceived, especially given that Fresno is a city that is traditionally not built for transit.
We've done a very good job of building an auto-dependent environment in Fresno. One of the things that drives our very high ridership is we have a very high poverty rate in Fresno. And so there are a lot of folks in our community who either can't afford a car or don't drive. And so the bus is really their option. It's the way they can conduct their business. So that's one of the things that drives our ridership. I mean, there are, you know, other economic factors that drive this thing as well and demographic factors. But the best thing I can say is we have very high ridership because we have a very impoverished community.
You mentioned the high poverty rate here, and those individuals, many of whom who use the Fresno Area Express service, don't have any other options. Recently, the city council approved rather significant rate hikes for users of the existing service. How would BRT, number one, be priced? And number two, how would it impact the existing service? Are we talking about replacing existing lines that service parts of the community on Ventura or Blackstone or maybe down the road on Shaw? Or is this a supplement to the existing service?
Well, two things. First of all, I would say that we're supplementing service, but we are combining two existing lines. Currently, Blackstone Avenue is served by our Route 30, and Ventura Kings Canyon is served by our Route 28. Now, those corridors will no longer be served by those routes when we establish the BRT corridor, but that doesn't mean that Route 30 and Route 28 are going to go away. They're going to be modified to do some other service. So we're supplementing the service. But we're supplementing it with a much higher quality service. The BRT lines will be running on 10-minute headways during peak periods, which is, you know, twice the headway we currently have on those corridors.
When you say headway, what do you mean?
Every 10 minutes a bus comes by. So, you know, the longest you have to wait for a bus, if you just saw the bus leaving when you got there, you've got 10 minutes to wait for the next bus, which is pretty darn good service.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned there will be less or fewer stops along the way. Are we looking at just a downtown to River Park express bus or stopping at Manchester, stopping at City College?
We will be stopping approximately every half mile. So the idea here is a half mile, the longest distance somebody along that corridor would have to walk is about a quarter of a mile, which is probably a little farther than they're used to walking now. But the benefit is when they get there, they've got very frequent service. It's going to be moving very fast. So that should help people out. Also, you know, they're going to be waiting at nicer stations. We're going to have station areas where people are going to have some amenities that will make it very comfortable to wait. Hopefully the waits aren't too long, like I said. But, you know, at the same time, it's the give is you walk a little bit farther, the gate is, but you get there a whole lot faster and in a more comfortable fashion.
Now, one of the problems with radio is we don't have pictures to show our listeners, but describe, if you can, the buses themselves. They're a little different than the normal buses we see today.
They're not what we're seeing in Fresno right now. They're actually called an articulated bus, and the best way to describe it, people tell me, it has an accordion in the middle of it. So it's a 60-foot-long vehicle that articulates or bends in the middle. So it actually can make just as sharp a turn as a standard bus, which is 40 feet long. And it's very comfortable to sit in, but it can carry a lot more people. So we can get a lot more people on this bus, which means you'll have a better opportunity for seats. So the other differences are they have – the bus rapid transit vehicles have some treatments we call cowlings, which if you think about in the early, you know, 40s or 50s, you had cars that had big moon-shaped hubs over their wheels so that the fender literally dropped down and covered the side of the wheel. When you look at the bus, it looks more like a train than a bus. They're very attractive, kind of high-tech looking vehicles. And so they're very interesting. I don't know what the branding is going to be yet. We haven't got that far along, but they will look completely different than any other bus in Fresno.
Again, if you just joined us on Quality of Life today, our guest is John Downs. He is the Planning Division Manager for the Department of Transportation for the City of Fresno and the Fresno Area Express Bus Service. And John is one of the individuals working on a project that's been several years in the making, bringing what's called bus rapid transit to Fresno. Assuming that this funding goes through in the 2012 federal budget, nearly $18 million, what sort of timetable are we looking at? $18 million doesn't pay for the whole project.
No, the entire project is just short of $50 million. I think it's $48.7, if I remember, million dollars. This first 18 is to get us through preliminary engineering and project design, which is technically what the Federal Transit Administration has granted us to go forward doing. So we're going to basically be fine-tuning this project, going very deeply into the environmental aspects and the modeling aspects of the process, doing the finely detailed engineering for some of those features we've talked about, such as the queue jump lanes and things like that. And once we've gotten all of those pieces together, then we go back to the Federal Transit Administration, and once they've signed off on that, then we're approved to go forward with the construction. If all goes well, the project would be constructed and we'd be operating in revenue service probably July 2013.
Now, one of the problems, and perhaps it's not even really a problem, but one of the issues with the existing service here in Fresno, and it came up during the debate on the fare hikes, is that fares only pay for a portion of the existing service.
Yes.
What about the operation of this new bus rapid transit system? Once it's installed, you have the federal money to build it and to build the stations, to buy the buses, do the traffic studies and environmental studies that are required. What about the ongoing operation of this type of a system? Is it going to be a burden on the existing system, or does it pay for itself more with higher fares? How does the operation plan develop?
Well, at this point, the fares are going to be the same. We're not planning on changing fares on this bus. I can't say the fares are always going to be where they are now. It had been 10 years since we'd raised fares. It's the first fare increase we've had in quite a while. And as everybody knows, the price of fuel and everything else has gone up, so we were bumping up against a target. Operationally, one of the federal requirements of this program is that we have an operations plan, and we have to be able to demonstrate that operating this particular service will not take more than 5% of our operating budget. That's one of the rules that we have to comply with. One of the things that you can look – because the system is more efficient operating faster on that corridor. I need to explain this, I suppose. In a typical corridor, you know, we have a cycle time. So let's say it takes you 90 minutes to get from one end of a route to the other route. So if you've got buses running every 30 minutes, you have to have three buses on that corridor. So if it's 90 minutes going up and 90 minutes coming back, now you need to have six buses on that corridor. One of the things that happens with bus rapid transit, because you can go through that corridor faster, what may have been a 90-minute corridor before it turns into a 30-minute corridor, or I should say a 60-minute corridor. So instead of having to operate it with six buses, now I can operate it with four buses. So there are some savings associated with bus rapid transit programs in that respect. And so, you know, we're hoping that when we get this all said and done, it's really not going to be too difficult for us. But part of the requirements of the grant are we must operate 10-minute headways in peak period, 15-minute headways off peak, and of course we have a state requirement that says we have to capture 20% of our operating costs through the fare box. That's a requirement from the state. Currently, our fare, as you'd mentioned, is a dollar and a quarter. It costs us about $2.11 for every trip we provide. So it is a subsidized fare, but that's the nature of public transit right now.
Now, looking again at these proposed bus rapid transit routes in Fresno, we're looking at, correct me if I'm wrong, downtown, up Blackstone, Abbey, that corridor
right.
out towards River Park in North Fresno, and then also from the downtown core out Ventura, Kings Canyon.
Exactly, to Clovis Avenue.
How were those routes selected in terms of the first two that you're looking for?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, as I said earlier, we had a pretty extensive process. We had really evaluated several corridors within the urban area. We looked at Cedar Avenue and Shaw Avenue and Clovis Avenue. I mean, there were just a lot of things. But two things I think really lended a lot of credibility to these two corridors. One thing is that they both have some of the highest ridership in our system. They're very strong corridors for us right now, currently. And that's, you know, not only because Blackstone is the spine of Fresno and there's a lot of activity there, but Ventura Kings Canyon goes right through a lot of those neighborhoods where we have a lot of transit-dependent folks living. So that's an important thing. The other thing that I think really adds some credibility to this is when you look at the city of Fresno's general plan, Blackstone Avenue is earmarked for a mid-rise corridor. So it's already designated to be one of the most intensive development corridors in our community. And the same with Ventura Kings Canyon. The current general plan shows us putting growth out in the southeast growth area. So there's a lot of growth being funded out there. So today they're strong corridors, and at least based on the way our current general plan is set up, tomorrow they're projected to be strong corridors. So we're simply, you know, carrying out what looks to be the way the city wanted to plan it.
I know some people look at a system like BRT and they say, why are we still looking at buses? Why aren't we talking about light rail? Sacramento area has a light rail service. You have light rail in other communities throughout the state, although not in this part of the valley. Why not light rail instead of a BRT system?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is we are looking at light rail. I mean, we have looked at it for quite a while, and we're continuing to look at it. The immediate response for today is we can't afford it. We don't have the densities that would support a light rail program at this point. But based on modeling we're doing, I'm running another study called the Public Transportation Infrastructure Study, and based on the modeling from that study, if we make the right decisions, land use decisions going forward, probably by 2025, maybe 2030, we would be able to support a light rail system along those corridors, the exact corridors we're talking about right now. And then it'll be a question of whether or not we can come up with the financial support for that. Light rail is many, many times more expensive than bus rapid transit. And so although it would be nice to be able to go that place right now, we just don't have the money to do it. But I think with some good urban planning, that's definitely in Fresno's future.
In terms of looking at these routes and bus rapid transit, one of the other, I guess, potential areas of critique might be, well, if you already have buses on these routes, why do you need these new buses? Why not just run your existing buses on this type of a schedule? Don't worry about the special type of station. Don't worry about some of these other things. What prevents the existing system from operating in this way? Is it just simply the timing, the signal issues, and those sorts of things?
There's a couple of ways of looking at that, and they're going to sound a little bureaucratic, and I apologize for that. But one of the things that happens here, if we already were operating a limited service or skip-stop service on those corridors, we would not qualify for the federal money to do the infrastructure improvements. So if we jump ahead of ourselves and start doing this before we have gone through this planning process, we would have prevented ourselves from acquiring the funding we need to do to make the nice infrastructure, the Q-jump lanes and the upgraded stations and all of those things. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, which I think is valid, one of the things we're trying to do is make the system more comfortable and more attractive. We'd like to attract more choice riders. We know from studies that choice riders are much more likely to take a system that has pleasant waiting areas, upgraded station areas, nicer buses, you know, some of those conveniences. So a combination of those things has kind of led us in this effort to say, well, we need to approach this in this fashion in order to get the best possible product we can get for our community.
Now, you mentioned another study you're working on with the Council of Governments of Fresno mm-hmm. County. And we don't really have time to talk too much about that study here today. But what I would like to ask is, seeing that Fresno is going down this path on BRT, have you talked to colleagues in other municipalities, whether it's in Fresno County or elsewhere in the Valley? Is there interest in watching what Fresno is doing with bus rapid transit in other Valley communities?
I think absolutely. I think, you know, Fresno County is probably, you know, leading the Valley right now in terms of doing some very advanced planning, along with the blueprint and the public transportation infrastructure study and our bus rapid transit program. I think, you know, there's a lot of interesting things happening right now. And, of course, as we try to find ways to solve our problems with SB 375 and satisfying those regulatory issues.
And that's the global warming reduction bill.
That becomes very important. Public transit may not be the only means of solving that. It certainly is a means of addressing global warming.
Now, how does this connect with high-speed rail? That's another huge topic of conversation when we talk about transportation in the state. Does this complement high-speed rail in some way?
I think it has the potential to complement high-speed rail. I have to be honest. I mean, we were well on our way with BRT planning before high-speed rail became, you know, much of an issue in Fresno. And certainly the BRT system will be down in very near the high-speed rail station in downtown Fresno, and it probably would complement that. But they're not really tied together at this point. I mean, we are certainly integrating transit into the high-speed rail station planning. Whether or not the BRT line is going to be directly into that station, I don't think is a decision that's been made yet, but it's been being talked about. So I think it can complement it. I think one of the challenges that I've shared with my colleagues is that I expect that when high-speed rail arrives in Fresno, that part of downtown Fresno would become very congested. And if it's very congested, it may not be the best place to try and run a bus rapid transit line through, because that would slow down the line. But that's, you know, that's all the planning that needs to happen as we go into the future.
Speaking of planning and future development, there's another element to bus rapid transit, and that's transit-oriented development.
Yes.
I assume this is talking about new proposed development along these corridors. Tell us about what we're looking at there and what might be in the future for Fresno.
Well, I think when we're looking in terms of – and this kind of relates back to the public transportation infrastructure study as well. When we're looking at these corridors and trying to develop a strong corridor, for instance, if we really wanted to evolve to a level that we would have a light rail program in Fresno, we really need to increase the densities and the mix of uses along those corridors. And I say mix of uses because it's not just business densities or residential densities. You really have to have – the origins and destinations all on that corridor in order to generate the level of public transit trip making that supports that. So all of these efforts are about looking at, you know, how do we intensify the corridors and how do we make them work. One of the things that we're looking at, for instance, is we look at transit-oriented development along that corridor. We're probably not looking at having transit-oriented development all along the corridor. We're probably looking at spacing them maybe every mile apart. Because at some point, you don't want to have to make more frequent stops because your density is everywhere. You want to have the stops happening so that you can accommodate that corridor. So as we go forward in the planning, I think the effort will be to look at key stations and say, how do we evolve station area plans around those stations that would support the type of transit-oriented development that would make this corridor strong? So there's a lot of interest in that, but I think sometimes people misunderstand when we're talking about high density, mixed use, or transit-oriented development. They think we mean to have it everywhere, and we don't. We mean to have it in those key station areas where it becomes important.
All right. Our guest today has been John Downs. He is the Planning Division Manager for the Department of Transportation with the City of Fresno and the Fresno Area Express Bus Service. John, if people want more information on BRT and some of these planning things that are going on, what can they do? Are there any public meetings or events that are coming up?
There's a lot of activities going on. The first thing I would say is there is a website called fasttrackfresnodowncounty.com. And if you go there, you can read about all of these studies. There's a lot of information up there. And, of course, we post all of the meetings. We've got some smart growth workshops planned for March. I believe it's the second and third at the Fresno Arts Museum. So that information should be getting out and being published. I know there's going to be some article or some ads in the Fresno Bee and some radio ads as well. So keep your ears open for that. Other than that, you know, call Fresno Area Express and ask to talk to the Planning Division. And my number there is 621-1502. And the other thing you can do is if you go to the City of Fresno website, go to the facts part of the website, and there's a planning library in that website. That's a public place. And you can just go in there and click on whatever documents you see about bus rapid transit or PTIS or whatever else is going on and get all the information you need, I think.
Great. Well, it's been very informative, John. Thank you so much for being a guest on our program today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with another side of the transportation issue, with an interview with a guest from the Public Policy Institute of California on the release of a new study that calls for the state to incentivize the use of public transportation in order to reach the state's ambitious goals for greenhouse gas reduction. That's coming up in just a moment on Quality of Life here on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the Bertha and John Garabedian Charitable Foundation, the Bonner Family Foundation, and Chevron.
There's talk, and then there's talk that matters. Tune into Talk of the Nation and hear experienced voices, informed views, and smart calls. We'll tackle the day's top stories and discuss the most interesting topics, the issues that affect you. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Tuesday morning at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
Welcome back to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. From the birth of the drive-through restaurant to the state's massive and often clogged freeways, the automobile is an integral part of the culture of the Golden State. But another big part of California culture, concern for the environment, is often at odds with this love affair with the automobile. According to the state's Air Resources Board, approximately 38% of greenhouse gas emissions in California come from transportation uses, and much of that comes from our cars. And while the state has enacted ambitious legislation designed to reduce those emissions by reducing the amount Californians drive, getting more residents to use mass transit is often difficult. It's not only a matter of supply, as we heard in the case of Fresno's BRT system, but also one of demand. One idea on reaching those pollution reduction goals is to create a system of incentives and disincentives that would encourage Californians to use transit and discourage the use of the personal automobile. Here to tell us more about what that sort of system might look like is Louise Bedsworth. She is a research fellow with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California and is joining us on the phone from Sacramento. Louise, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Louise is the co-author of a new study called Driving Change, Reducing Vehicle Miles Traveled, which was released by the Institute last week. Louise, we know the state is looking for ways to encourage Californians to choose a particular option in their transportation. What specifically does your study call for in terms of incentives and disincentives?
Well, we looked at what is happening around the state. There are really three primary ways to get people out of their car. One is to increase density and change land use patterns so that people don't need to drive as much. The second is to invest in transit and other alternatives to driving, such as biking and walking. And the third are pricing strategies to incentivize people to seek alternatives to driving by making driving more expensive. And so in our study, what we've really looked at is and recommend is taking an integrated approach. So we need to think about how we put all of these pieces together and combine land use with investment in transit, and also include a pricing component so we actually can encourage people to make those changes and to take advantage of investments that we do make in transit.
Now, one of the things we've been talking about is SB 375, and to step outside of the lingo of Sacramento, explain to our listeners what we're talking about. This is one of a number of bills that have been passed and signed by the governor, in this case dealing with greenhouse gas reduction.
Yes.
Tell us a little more about that.
Well, right. In 2006, California adopted the Global Warming Solutions Act, which calls for the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. The largest source of reductions is going to come from the transportation sector, and that's going to be through improvements in vehicles, changes in fuels, as well as reductions in the amount people drive. And that's where SB 375 comes in. And SB 375 calls for regional planning to take into account reductions of greenhouse gas emissions. And so over the next, by 2020 and 2035, the state's regions will need to be planning in a way that they're meeting targets set by the state.
Now, we're looking at these different regions, and in our program today, we're specifically looking at the Central Valley,
mm-hmm.
one of the big efforts that's underway right now, and in fact, funding is in President Obama's proposed budget for 2012 to begin the process of funding a bus rapid transit system for Fresno and looking at transit-oriented development and trying to incentivize those sorts of uses. What are you seeing as the keys to driving usage of that sort of transportation?
In our study, we took a look at development of transit over the last couple of decades around California, and specifically looked at the growth of employment around transit centers, because what our research shows is that employment density, that is the number of jobs per unit area around a transit station, is a more important determinant of people actually taking transit than housing density or how tightly packed housing is. So while both density and both housing and business or employment matters, for transit use, employment density is more important. And so we took a look at transit stations around the state and found that while we've invested significantly in transit development, we have not seen, on average around the state, a growth of employment around these stations. And so what that suggests, and we also haven't seen a significant increase in the use of transit for commuting. We've seen small increases, but they are very small. And so what that suggests is that we need to focus a bit more on how we grow and develop around our transit system, and specifically focus on development of commercial uses and of employment opportunities around those transit nodes.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's a little bit of a different approach than is spelled out in SB 375, which, again, as you said, puts an emphasis on the residential development, having these dense residential projects near transit centers. You're saying that there needs to be more of a focus on commercial development.
Yes. I mean, I think traditionally around the state, the focus around transit-oriented development and densification has been traditionally on thinking about increase the density of housing, and in the words of one regional planner, they told us, well, jobs will take care of themselves. And I think part of what our study shows, jobs don't take care of themselves. And so I do think we need to shift to be thinking more holistically and thinking more broadly about how we spur that commercial development, because what we've seen is it's not taking care of itself. And because of that, we're missing an opportunity in our transit investment and probably not getting as much out of it as we could be.
If you just joined us, our guest today on Quality of Life is Louise Bedsworth. She is a research fellow with the Public Policy Institute of California, and we're talking about a new study that's just been released about trying to incentivize the use of transit and its associated development in the Golden State. Now, one of the more potentially controversial aspects of this particular study deals with some of the financial incentives, or shall we say disincentives, for use of the traditional one-person occupied automobile. Tell us about what you found there.
Well, the research shows, and this is research from a wide variety of sources, that one of the most effective tools for getting people to drive less is to increase the cost of driving. And we saw this back in 2008 when gas prices went quite high in the state. We saw a perceptible, measurable drop in the amount that people drive. And we hadn't seen that in quite some time. And, you know, it occurred at the same time as we started to have a downturn in the economy, but part of that was certainly due to this increase in gas price. So pricing is a very important and powerful tool to get people to drive less. We have had a gas or fuel tax in place, but it's been unchanged since the 1990s. So that has definitely dampened any price signal that it is sending. And not only is that not sending a signal to drivers about how much they're driving, but it also is reducing the amount of money that we're generating to invest back into our transportation system. So pricing strategies can be a win-win where we get the reduction in driving, we also get some revenues to invest back into our transportation system. And that's not just roads, that's including things like transit and alternatives to driving. So I think pricing is a very important component of an integrated strategy. And so you need to be thinking about providing alternatives for people, but then you need to get the incentive for people to use those alternatives that you invest in.
Are you looking at a gas tax, more of a toll-based structure, or something that I've seen more recently is a mileage fee that people would pay? What does your study particularly examine in this case?
We haven't looked specifically at or evaluated different options for different regions. I think ideally you're going to, you know, with any pricing signal, it's going to be related directly, as directly as possible to use. So things like a VMT fee, vehicle miles traveled fee, that is specifically targeted to how much people drive, you know, in some senses would be an optimal approach. And there are technologies that enable that to happen. But, you know, really you could see a variety of approaches. They could vary by region and be what's most appropriate for different regions. But, you know, in the Bay Area, for instance, there's been a lot more investment and future and planned investment in high occupancy toll lanes. And so those are carpool lanes that carpools can use for free, but people can pay a toll, as a single occupant vehicle and also travel in those lanes to get the time savings. So that's the strategy that could work in some regions. It can also be, on a local level, a parking strategy. And there have been several areas that have had very successful strategies where they have really looked at how they price parking to encourage and grow development in their downtown core, but also encourage the use of alternatives and reduce driving.
You've talked about a regional approach. One of the things that's very different about the Central Valley is our land use patterns, very much different than what you would find in the Bay Area or to some degree in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. What does this mean for the Central Valley that we know today? Certainly there's talk about more transit-oriented development, more density, smart growth. But to some extent, we already have a built infrastructure that we're dealing with. What does this mean for the low-density suburban-type landscape that we find throughout so much of Central California?
Well, I think a lot of it is looking towards new development and thinking how to tie new development into that existing system. The other is, you know, as transit is being developed around that system, of thinking about how to do it in such a way that it will get maximum, you'll get your maximum utility out of it. So you'll get people to use it more. So that could be focusing on, again, the job growth around transit so that people, you know, can use the transit to get to jobs and things like that. So I think it's both really putting a critical eye on future development and then thinking about how you develop your transit and your system onto that existing infrastructure.
One other challenge that we have here in the Valley, we've talked about it on this program today before you joined us, and that's specifically our existing public transit systems here in the Valley. Yes, they have seen great ridership increases in the midst of the economic downturn we've experienced in the past 3 or 4 years, but to a large extent, ridership does not cover bear the entire cost of the service. If we incentivize people to leave the cars at home by, in some way, raising the cost of using the personal automobile, we generate more demand for transit, but does that pay for itself? How do we accommodate that?
Well, I think, you know, that's a very good point, and I think it's important and certainly a huge challenge right now. The cuts that are facing transit are very difficult for all regions. I do think it's important to note transit systems are going to require a subsidy, but we subsidize existing road travel as well. And so I don't think it's a fair metric to say that transit systems need to be able to pay for themselves. Of course, as they get more and more use, we're going to need to invest more and more in them. And we've seen a shift in transportation spending with more and more emphasis being placed on transit. So I think there are definitely challenges right now, in particular, because of the financial downturn that we're experiencing. And I think we'll just have to look in the future, and especially, you know, if we are hopefully successful in making this shift of investing more and more into our transportation system.
And finally, one last question. Is there any idea about how the longer-term and longer-distance type of travel accommodated by perhaps high-speed rail in the future, how this might fit into the overall transit outlook for the state?
I think much of that will depend on how something like high-speed rail is implemented. And if it is envisioned as something to connect commuting centers, you know, the Bay Area to the San Joaquin Valley or to Los Angeles, you know, things like that, versus a replacement for airports. And so I think it will depend quite a bit on how we end up implementing and using a high-speed rail system.
Well, Louise, thank you very much for the interesting comments today and this new study, again, Driving Change, Reducing Vehicle Miles Traveled, from the Public Policy Institute of California. Louise, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with a personality profile, so to speak, as we talk with recently retired State Appellate Court Justice James Ardiz. We'll get some insights into the legal system, his career, and more right after this.
Friends, this week on Valley Writers Read Wednesday at 7, we get to meet Maddie and Bernard, both senior citizens, in a story by Bakersfield author Charlotte Abrams. Maddie lost Harry not too long ago, while Bernard, who's 90, lost Bella years ago. Out of neighborliness, Bernard takes over where Harry left off as far as taking care of Maddie's yard. So to pay him back, Maddie invites him over for dinners on Fridays. They play little gin, sometimes Scrabble. But then Maddie is invited out on a date the next Friday, and she moves the dinners to Thursdays. Meanwhile, Bernard had to be admitted to the hospital where she visits him. Because he's not all that sick, the doctor releases him. So what do you think happened on Maddie's date and with those Friday night dinners? It's all on Valley Writers Read Wednesday at 7. Join us.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. Last month, the 5th District Court of Appeals presiding justice, the Honorable James Ardiz, retired after a career stretching more than 3 decades on the bench. He was appointed to the 5th District in 1988 by then-Governor George Dukmejian and was appointed presiding justice by Governor Pete Wilson in 1994. And he joins us in our studio today. Justice Ardiz, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's rather unusual for a justice to retire at a relatively young age, I should say. Tell us about your decision at stepping down last month.
Well, it was a combination of things. One of the things that people don't understand is under the Constitution, once a judge enters his or her term of office, there are certain restrictions in terms of what they can do if they resign or retire from that term of office. In this case, I would be entering a new term of office of 12 years, and I had intended to retire sometime during that period. Had I done that, I would have been precluded by law from accepting any kind of public office. I couldn't even teach in a public high school under the Constitution for a period of 12 years. And I had hoped to go back to teaching. And also there was an impact on my retirement. My retirement began to decrease. So it had an adverse impact, particularly with respect to my wife. So I decided that it was time for me to do something else, and I wanted to recreate myself.
So now in your retirement, I understand you're quite busy. Tell us about some of the things you're involved with. This program called JAMS, which is looking at mediation and arbitration, bringing that to the Valley.
Yes, JAMS is the largest mediation and arbitration organization in the world. They have 250 mediators worldwide. And they spoke to me about bringing their service to the Central Valley, and I agreed to do that. So it brings a level of arbitration mediation expertise which is very sophisticated. I mean, there are people here that do this, and many are quite good at it. JAM simply brings a whole different level, and I agreed to do that on term and condition that I could also do community service work and other public educational work.
Now, I understand you're also very involved in teaching. You've taught before, and teaching happens to be in your future as well.
Yes, I agreed to resume teaching for San Joaquin College of Law, and I will be teaching evidence in the fall, which may come as a shock to some of the students out there listening. And I hope to become actively involved with young people at the high school level with respect to legal issues and perhaps some of the magnet schools here in the Valley.
Tell us about your experience on the bench. You have had a wide range of experience from the 5th District to lower courts, trial courts. Tell us about maybe what was your favorite aspect of your many jobs that you've held over the years, and what really resonated with you.
Well, I've been a chief deputy district attorney in charge of homicide, a municipal court judge, a presiding judge, a superior court judge, a presiding judge, an appellate court judge, and a presiding judge. I've enjoyed each aspect of it, but I honestly have to say that the job I enjoyed more than anything was being chief of homicide for the district attorney's office. I suppose it's – you get the toughest cases. It just is a job that I thoroughly enjoyed. I can't say my family enjoyed it as much, but I did. After that, I really kind of moved into administration. And I've helped courts, helped judges in terms of administration, and I probably prefer being an appellate court judge. I've enjoyed that. It's a little more intellectual, and there's a little more time to work on things. I mean, trial judges have an incredibly difficult job. It's the toughest job in the system. I wasn't sorry to leave it, and I enjoyed my time as an appellate court judge. But my favorite job in the system was chief of homicide.
Now, during your time as presiding justice here in the 5th District, one of the things that you did in working with the state Supreme Court is outreach. I think the judicial system and the judicial branch of government is perhaps the least understood and perhaps the most powerful as well. Tell us about some of the things that you've tried to do to demystify the courts and
the courts depend for their authority on credibility. They have no army. They have no enforcement power independent of their orders. They depend upon respect. They depend upon credibility. For people to accept the decisions of the court, it's very important that the court be transparent and that people at least can relate to the decision and feel like this is an impartial body making those decisions. And in line with that, I've tried to do things in the Valley that would help to enhance transparency. And one of those things has been bringing the Supreme Court here, televising it, bringing our high school students in so that they could participate in the process and allowing the public to see it. Making the court very open and accessible to the community. Those are the things that I've tried to do. Fresno was the first court, the 5th District Court of Appeal was the first court to do anything like this, and it was the first time the Supreme Court had ever done anything like this. So convincing them to do it was a major accomplishment. And when they celebrated their 10-year anniversary and it was the Chief Justice's, Ron George's, last public appearance, he actually wanted to do it in Fresno and he wanted to celebrate the anniversary of that program here since it had been so successful statewide. And that's what brought them back here. And I'm very proud of that. I think it's been a very beneficial thing for the community.
One of the interesting things about that visit, it was televised. That's not something that normally happens. And the courts, the judicial branch is often very much tied to tradition. That was an untraditional thing. What do you think the role of innovation and those sorts of things. How does that interact with the idea of tradition with the court?
Well, you know, judges tend to isolate themselves from the community. It's just the nature of the job. Tradition plays a role in that. It's like robes. Why do you wear robes? Why do you sit higher than the people in the courtroom? Why do courtrooms look the way that they do? And judges become used to that. There's consistency in it. The idea of deviating from that, kind of penetrating the mystique, can create insecurity. And I think that was part of the problem with the Supreme Court and the idea of being televised, people to actually see us. Of course, you could walk in and sit in a courtroom and watch them. But the idea of being televised, there was concern that it detracted from the dignity of the court and the dignity of the process. But the court voted on it. They became quite enamored of it, actually, and now it's simply become part of their practice. But I think that that is extremely important in letting people see the highest court in the state. They can actually see the faces. They can hear the voices. They actually see that these are human beings that do relate to them. They have real questions. They're not isolated people. They just have very isolated positions, and that may sound inconsistent, but it really isn't. I mean, judges read the newspapers. Judges understand the consequences far more than people realize. I think a lot of people really have no concept of what it's like to actually be a judge and understand the impact of the decisions. They just see a rather impassive individual. They don't understand that that person goes home at the end of the day and they do think about what they've done. And they do feel it. They just have to deal with it in a different way than other people do.
What's maybe the biggest misconception that people may have about the job that you held or anyone in your position?
That you don't care about the consequences. I think people think that judges make legal decisions, and which they do, but that they don't care. I mean, there have been times when I've made decisions and my wife has read about them in the paper, and my wife is a teacher, and she'll say, did you do this? And I'll say, yes, I did. She'll say, well, you know, I don't agree with that. And then she'll proceed to tell me why she doesn't agree with that. And that's fine. My answer is you didn't have to make the decision. You don't understand. My job is one that I believe if the average person understood the law and understood the issues – I want them to have confidence that I did the best that could be done under the circumstances. It isn't so much that they have to precisely agree as it is that they have to have confidence. And they have to understand that I don't know a single judge that doesn't feel the pain of the people in front of them. You see people. You see the grief. You see the impact. You see the tears, and you have to make a decision. You take somebody's child away from them, and you look at them and you say, this is my decision. You do feel that. You just can't show that. And when you go back, you realize what you have done. And the way you deal with it is by attempting as much as possible to follow the law and not allowing your personal emotions or your personal feelings to enter into it. I mean, my job doesn't allow me, at least the job that I held, doesn't allow me to simply do things because I think that's the way things should be. It requires me to accept the judgment of the legislature as to the law and to follow the law, and that should dictate the result, not my emotions, not my preferences. And that's the hard thing about being a judge that other people don't face. They can live their lives with their preferences. I can't. But don't think for one moment that there are not nights that I went home like every other judge and sat down and thought about the impact of what I had done. You sentence somebody to be executed, you're going to think about what you're doing, and you understand that. And you have to live with that. And I've seen judges do that. And I've actually seen judges sentence a man to be executed and go in their chambers and cry because of their personal opposition to the death penalty, for example. People don't see that, and they don't understand how much pain that, that person is going through.
If you just joined us on Quality of Life today on Valley Public Radio, our guest is recently retired Presiding Justice of the 5th District Court of Appeals, the Honorable James Ardize. You were talking about the impact that those types of decisions can have on a judge. How does maybe a new judge on the bench prepare oneself to deal with those circumstances? Is that part of the process, or is it just assumed that?
No, there's when you come to the bench, presumably because the Constitution requires that you have 10 years of experience as a lawyer, you come in with a certain amount of legal experience. You also come in with a certain amount of presumably accepted ability that you have with respect to the law. But a lot of people aren't prepared for the fact that when they get on the bench, everybody's looking at you and now you're expected to know what to do. A lot of times lawyers don't pay any attention to what the judge does. It's surprising. And when you're a new judge, the hardest thing to get used to is that the decision rests with you. You're guiding everything. You're making immediate decisions. Some of them are, you know, within a matter of seconds that have tremendous impact. And you have to be decisive. That's one thing that people don't really appreciate, how decisive you must be. You can't spend time hesitating because trials are expensive processes and you have to make those decisions and you try to be right. You're not always going to be right, accepting that. Those are the things that you have to get used to. And then the other thing is, how do you decide difficult cases? Because they're almost always difficult cases. And I think almost every judge struggles with that. And I had older judges that I went to and said, how do you do this? And they mentored me. There's a tremendous mentoring process that takes place. California has the most sophisticated judicial education system in the world. People don't realize that. Our judges go to Berkeley. They go through what we call judicial college. They go through extensive training. But all of them are mentored. And I had older judges that that sat down with me and that I could talk to and help me with that and help me to learn what I had to do and how to deal with it. So it's a process and it's an evolution. The turning from a lawyer into a judge is not immediate. Turning from a judge into an appellate court judge is not immediate. It takes time before you feel a certain amount of comfort in what you're doing and you accept the role. Some people can't handle it. And I've seen judges that just simply can't do it. They don't have the ability to be that decisive. They can't make a decision.
Well, thank you very much for your insights. Our guest today in this last part of our program has been the recently retired 5th District Court of Appeals Presiding Justice, the Honorable James Ardize. He retired from the bench this past January, and he's now pursuing a number of different endeavors, including teaching law and also a mediation and arbitration program here in the Valley. Justice Ardize, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org and interact with us on Twitter at @kvpr. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, and production manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.